Support for this public radio podcast is provided by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. And by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy-efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works.
Welcome to Cairo.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Live from Cairo, Egypt, I'm Scott Jagow. This is the Cairo street. Chaotic and polluted, certainly, but always brimming with life. For the next week, we'll show you the Middle East at work, how people do business in this vital part of the world. The first person we'll meet is Khalid Al-Khamisi. He spent a year in Cairo taxis, simply talking to their drivers. Then he wrote a book about this frustrated working class. We hopped a cab with him to hear more. But since this is Egypt, first we negotiate with the driver. Once we got comfortable, I asked Khalid what his book says about Egypt and the people of Cairo.
Many people speak about oppression in terms of political oppression, but what we suffer here in Egypt, it is the economical oppression. Egypt has a potential, and this potential is gone 100%.
100%, that sounds pretty hopeless.
Yes, I think we are in a hopeless situation, and the people has to work 20 hours a day to survive.
Khalid, can you give me a story, one that stands out to you that might represent the book?
I can tell you one story. It's about a taxi driver. He told me that a police officer, after 1 hour in the taxi, he asked him, give me your ID. And he knew that he wants money. And then he gave him £5. And the officer told him, this is not enough. He gave him £10. And these £10 are the only money this taxi driver has in 5 or 6 hours work.
At the end of the book, after reading all these stories where you felt a sense of hopelessness, the last story seemed to have some hope to it. Did you feel a sense of hope at the end when you were finished with this book?
For sure, we cannot live without hope. I think the Egyptian people has the power of making jokes every day. This is also our hope, our real hope.
Can you tell me one of the jokes that stands out to you?
I can tell you the joke of the day.
Okay, fair enough.
Cairo, it's 18 million people.
Right.
And 18 million people in one city, it's a lot. I want to go there. It's 5 minutes walk and 3 hours by the car.
That really kind of sums it up. Khalid, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure riding in a cab with you.
Thank you very much. This is my pleasure.
Check out the video diary of our taxi ride at marketplace.org. Yesterday, Egypt reopened its Gaza border, roughly 200 miles from where I am. Egypt let in Palestinians injured during Israeli airstrikes the past week. The border was closed to stop the flow of Palestinians. Egypt already has the largest population in the Middle East. Cairo is spilling into the desert. Diane Singerman co-edited the book Cairo Cosmopolitan. She explains.
People started figuring out to build however they could on what was formerly marginal land, and a lot of people are either lower middle class or living on the margins between poverty and the middle class. And these days, about half of all residents in Cairo live in informal housing areas.
This is an ancient city. Just modern Cairo dates back more than 1,000 years. How does a city that's so old maintain its infrastructure?
Well, it's difficult. It's quite difficult. And actually, there has been a lot of investment in infrastructure, the building of a new ring road around Cairo, the building of a metro, which is very important. But a lot of that has to do with the tourist industry. For example, one of my colleagues, Petra Kupinger, argues about the pyramids. Are you going to build a new museum that will really sort of create Cairo as an international city for $350 million at the Giza Plateau, Or are you going to worry about the houses that are falling down and the people who don't have water and the people who don't have security of tenure in their villages right next to the pyramids? It's not a zero-sum game. I don't want to be naive about that. Tourism creates lots of revenues. It produces lots of employment. But when people see the kind of investments and the economies that are oriented around tourists, when that vision of Cairo is more important than the way people live their lives, it gets really sensitive.
Well, if you look around the Middle East, you have these new glistening cities like Dubai, where there's so much investment. You have places like Saudi Arabia that are thriving from oil money. Where does Cairo fit into this new Middle East?
Certainly Egyptians will tell you Cairo is really the center of the Arab world. Sort of its cultural and historical legacy is huge. But the question is, can Cairo afford globalization? There seems to be sort of a bifurcation developing where you have fantastic shopping malls. You have the media city. And Egypt is trying to compete. But Egypt doesn't have the wealth that Dubai does. And what's important to remember about those countries is wealth without citizenship. And so many of the people in those countries are migrants and they don't have citizenship. And so Egypt has to deal with the fact that they have citizens. They don't just have migrants in their country. And so some of the things that Dubai has been able to do, Egypt can't do.
Diane Singerman, she's the co-editor of Cairo Cosmopolitan, along with Paul Amar. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was great.
My interview with Professor Singerman continues at marketplace.org. We talk about money and marriage in Egypt. It's the Middle East at Work. Live from Cairo, Egypt, I'm Scott Jagow. Today we begin a week of broadcasts from a region that is vital to the world economy. We'll show you the Middle East at work in all its remarkable contradictions, ancient and modern, rich and poor, violent and spiritual. The past few days, violence has reigned in the Gaza Strip. Israeli airstrikes killed more than 100 Palestinians, including civilians. Today, Israel pulled out of northern Gaza, stopping their offensive against Gaza militants who were launching rocket attacks. Here in Egypt, there are also tensions, mainly of the economic variety. More than 100,000 Iraqis have come to escape the war. But jobs are scarce. Some Egyptians resent the Iraqis being here. And in Jordan, there are even more refugees, about 750,000 people from Iraq. We begin in Amman with a story from Alisa Roth.
Last year, Acer and Mar took their three kids and one big suitcase and rode a bus from their home in Baghdad to Amman. It was after they were ordered to shut down their computer shop or be killed, after Mar had been kidnapped and beaten, and after a bomb knocked down part of the house they'd been living in. In Amman, they're safe. But that's about the only thing in their lives they're sure about.
Next year, what will happen? I don't know. The future is very black for me. Every day, I don't know.
Acer's in her late 30s. She loves Agatha Christie novels and Oprah. She has long dyed blonde hair, which she covers with a scarf when she goes out, so she won't offend anybody. Mar's a little bit younger than she is, with fair skin and dark hair, and glasses that make him look more serious than he is. He's kind of a homebody.
I don't have cigarettes. I don't have the opportunity to go to an internet cafe. I stay home. Go out and do what? There is no one. Even if I go out, I don't have money to spend.
They don't have money because they're both working menial jobs, illegally. He has a porter in a travel agency. She has a sales clerk in a discount store. Even 12-year-old Tagreed, the middle child, realizes how precarious their lives are.
There is no future here. I feel it is better to live in a foreign country. I can learn English, know the world. In Iraq, we have nothing.
Tagreed and her siblings have a game they play with the tops of soda cans. They use the tab like a kind of wishbone and take turns flicking it. Whoever breaks it off wins and gets to make a wish. But whoever wins, the wish is always the same, to get sent to the U.S. or Canada. It's what their mother wishes, too. She's counting on the United Nations to resettle them.
Where else do I have to go? I don't have choices. I'm stuck.
Maybe more stuck than she realizes, since the likelihood they'll get resettled is exceedingly slim. Meanwhile, though, the family's limbo gets a little more permanent every day they spend in Jordan. The kids go to school, they're making friends, and without even realizing it, they sometimes speak Arabic with a Jordanian accent. In Amman, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Elisa's profile of the family continues tomorrow. We move on now to how much the Iraq War is costing us. In 2003, the U.S. government predicted $60 billion. But the authors of a new book say it's now $3 trillion. I asked Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz and Harvard professor Linda Bilmes about their calculation.
When they talked about $50, $60 billion at the beginning of the war, they didn't talk about what the cost of health care for the returning veterans alone will be.
So we're talking about costs that we didn't really anticipate or put into the equation, but we've been in wars before. Linda, why wouldn't we factor those in?
In this war, there have been an unusually high number of very serious injuries troops have survived, which is a tribute to battlefield medicine, but at the same time, it means that the United States will carry for many, many decades the cost of taking care of disabled veterans from these wars.
All right, so we have this huge tab. Where is all this money coming from?
We borrowed the money. We cut taxes as we went to war, and that meant there were already deficits, but the war has been totally financed, in a sense, by borrowing.
I also want to point out that the $3 trillion, that is not including interest payments on the debt. If you add in the interest, it reaches even higher.
Since we are in this bind, how do you two propose that we get ourselves out of it?
Well, we have called for a system of clear financial accounting. Secondly, we have called for an end of the current practice, which has been to fund the war through these so-called emergency supplemental funding packages, which don't go through the regular budget process because they're supposed to be for emergencies like Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, you have corruption and profiteering and the Halliburton-type problems that result when nobody of either party gets to really look at the money that's being spent.
Let's say that your number is pretty accurate, the $3 trillion number. And let's say in a perfect world that somehow there was stability that was brought about in the Middle East because of this war. After doing all this research and writing this book, would you be okay with spending $3 trillion for that?
$3 trillion is a lot of money. Let me make clear about that. And with $3 trillion, you could have done a lot better, I think, in winning the hearts and minds of people not only in the Middle East, but all over the world. And therefore, you would have provided a more solid foundation for peace and security in the Middle East.
And Linda?
I would simply say that people deserve the chance to understand what this war is really costing and then decide whether they think it's worth it or not.
Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, authors of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Middle East blogs at marketplace.org. In Cairo, Egypt, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.